Hi everyone, this is Deb from Dying to be Found. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Okay, we're recording.
Are we reading or is this just still like an intro we're talking?
I think let's just talk. What do you think?
Okay, go.
Okay. We are so excited about starting this podcast. Beth, I'm a little bit nervous.
I am too.
So here's what I was thinking in the commute to work today. One of the things that I wanted to talk about to the listeners was the fact that how we kind of came up with the name Dying to be Found. In my opinion, and you can certainly tell me what you think, it's not always about sinister stories of evil people. I want the broadcast itself to be open to interpretation to our listeners. So we can talk about missing persons or anything that we feel that kind of falls into people who just are holding out for hope. That can, yes, include some of the stories that you hear on the news, like we're going to talk about today. But I just kind of wanted to let our listeners know that we are thinking about you and we want you to, if you have any stories that you want us to cover. It is not just about true crime. It is also about missing persons and things like that. So if you have a story that you would love to hear, please send us an email at dying2found@gmail.com. But you can also visit us on our website at dyingtobefound.com. And that's actually spelling the whole thing out. So I'm going to try to get some consistency there. We're getting started. I'm excited. Beth's excited. What is going on in your neck of the woods?
I was working afternoons yesterday and or evenings, and I get off work at 11 and drive 40 kilometers an hour home, which what that might be about 30 miles an hour. I get into my parking space. I got stuck, so I had to back out and I had to shovel just to park my car.
Oh my gosh. I live in the United States and there was an incident a couple years ago where I was trying to be a good wife and I was running my car up and down the driveway to kind of make tracks because I don't know if you've ever done that, Beth. One of the reasons why I've never moved back to Canada is because I don't want to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to shovel. But I can't believe you had to shovel to get into your parking space. So when I was backing up and going up and down so that the tire marks were leaving like a track so that John could come in and park, I ended up doing a 180 and slamming into my mailbox. You all, my sister dropped off. She's not even in this meeting anymore. Hold that thought. It looks like hopefully she's going to be able to log back on. So in the meantime, just be kind. I have this saying on my wall, and it's all about just being kind, and kindness will follow you. I just wanted you all to think about that. Beth's not here yet. Okay, so this is what I remember about Beth when we were growing up. She's my older sister, and I was the youngest. So if anybody out there is the youngest, you know you get babied a lot. We have three sisters. It's Beth, and then my other sister, and then myself. Well, it always seemed like Beth and I used to gang up on our other sister. Her name's Kathy, by the way. But in the meantime, it was either always Beth and me against Kathy or Kathy and me against Beth. Who came out the winner here? I'm thinking it was me. Welcome back, Beth. We've been talking about you.
You have?
I've been telling everybody about our childhood a little bit.
Oh.
I guess you're going to have to listen to find out.
I guess I will. My computer keeps freezing and then it crashes.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're in episode one and you guys were learning. It's a teachable moment for Beth and myself on how to do a podcast, but it's going to be one of the best because we're going to take on North America, right?
Right.
Okay. Do you want to finish telling me about the snow? Because I think I got sidetracked and told you about my 180 and smashing the mailbox.
So as I was moving into my spot, I couldn't get in, so I parked it out a little ways and I continued shoveling. And then I went to drive around a little block so that I could just run right into the snow so I wouldn't get stuck. And in the meantime,
wait, are you talking about taking a running start into the snow?
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
My dear husband with his huge, massive truck happened to be in the parking spot because he just got home from his afternoon shift. So he went back and forth with some of his big wheels.
Like I did.
Yeah.
But he's probably got those snow tires on. I didn't. Because I live in America where we don't get much snow. You all, I have not lived in Canada as a grown adult. I don't even think I had my driver's license. But Beth, do you have to shovel your driveway, like shovel your area just to get out every morning to go to work?
Depends on the winter.
That's why I don't move up north anymore. What else you want to talk about? Anything or should we get going?
Well, we may as well get going.
Okay, let's get going. I want to talk about Susan Smith. Do you ever remember watching that show, Criminal Minds?
Oh, yeah.
At the very beginning of that show, there's like a mosaic of people's mug shots. And I kept zoning in on one person in particular. I could not put my finger on who that person was until I literally started doing the research on this case that I'm going to talk about today, which is Susan Smith from South Carolina. Do you know much about her or just what was in the news?
Just what was in the news.
Okay. So I'll just kind of get started in her early life and move through high school. She was born Susan Lee Vaughn Smith on September 26th, 1971. Her parents' names were Linda Sue Harrison and Harry Vaughn. And they lived in Union, South Carolina, which is just east of Greenville. Greenville's a pretty big hub in South Carolina. So she lived just east of Greenville. She was the youngest of three children. She had two older brothers. And grew up in an extremely dysfunctional household. Even though her parents argued in front of the kids all the time, Susan kept her dad on a pedestal. Unfortunately, when she was 7 years old, he did commit suicide after her parents' divorce. I can imagine losing a parent at that age could be pretty detrimental. From there, she was a little bit destructive. And a few years later, her mom ended up marrying another man who, when Susan was 16, the stepdad at that point molested her. She reported this abuse to her counselor and her mother. Social services did nothing. There is speculation that Susan may have been convinced to drop the charges. I'm sure that was quite awkward for the people in the house. Okay, so in high school, as Susan got a little bit older, she did become somewhat promiscuous and even began relationships with married men. But on the good note, though, as a good civilian, as we all are, trying to do our duty and volunteer services in high school, she belonged to Civitan Club, which is known for community service. And the senior yearbook had her titled as the friendliest female. So
wow.
I couldn't really find much more about that. So I'm really not sure if there's those two things tied in about her promiscuity, but we'll just call her the friendliest female. She eventually ended up marrying David Smith on March 15th, 1991, after she told David that she was pregnant with her first child. The couple's first son was Michael Daniel Smith, and he was born on October 10th, 1991. Just 4 months later, in March of 1992, Susan and David separated, but they continued their on-again, off-again relationship. They remained married, but they were separated, and they frequently had affairs while they were married. On November 1992, I guess this is when they were no longer on a break, Susan ended up getting pregnant again with Alexander Tyler Smith, who was born August 5th, 1993. So she had two little ones pretty close in age together, trying to work it out with her husband. But because Susan had a history, she was continuing to have those marital affairs after the boys were born. And then in 1994, Susan began having an affair with her boss's son. He basically told Susan that he did not want to get married. He did not want to have any kids. He did not want to deal with Susan's kids. So I guess my question to you, Beth, is how long would you stay in a relationship with somebody who just blatantly says, yeah, I don't really want to deal with your kids?
Zip nada.
Okay, so believe it or not, she actually got a Dear Jane letter. And if you're old enough to know a Dear John or Dear Jane letter before all these emails came out, well, Susan was the recipient of one, pretty much saying everything that I had just mentioned about him not wanting to have any kids or dealing with hers. Based on Susan's background, Beth, what do you think was starting to go through Susan's head at this point? I mean, okay, we're talking about rejection. We think we love someone, but they don't love us. What do you think was going on in her head? Do you know anybody who's been in a situation like that?
Did she tell Tom that she would leave her husband?
Well, I mean, that would be great if she would leave her husband, but she didn't want to leave the boys with David. She said, no, it was not going to stop there. She just decided that, nope, I'm not going to say anything to my husband. There's no reason to leave him. But after receiving that Dear Jane letter, Susan unfortunately contemplated self-harm and did not want her boys to suffer because of what she witnessed when she was a child, when her dad completed suicide. I'm not in this situation. I've never been in this situation. I don't know anybody in this situation, but it just seems to me like you're young and you just think that one person in your life is all that. Well, you know, you're going to do everything that you can to try to make it work, right? At least from your end.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So on October 25th of 1994, Susan drove home, got both kids, and just began driving around 8 o'clock at that night. Have you ever gotten in the car with your kids just to drive around? I mean, I have known people, especially if you have like a colicky baby or something, and sometimes those car rides are very soothing. Have you ever put your kids in the car just to drive around? I mean, it could be because that was a good, fast way for them to fall asleep.
I remember one time when my son, probably around 2 years old, wouldn't fall asleep when we were in a cottage. So we took him for long rides. We took turns, my husband and I, to drive around, and it was moose territory. And that's what crossed our minds. Oh my gosh, are we going to hit a moose?
Holy cow.
We went back and forth a couple times. The kid never slept.
Oh. No, I don't think I've ever done that. My kids were pretty good. Question for you, Beth. Don't you have a boat?
Yes. Okay. We go boating often on Lake Huron.
Okay. That was my ocean growing up. I'm just kind of bringing that up about boating because are you good with measurement?
Not at all.
Oh, gosh, me neither, Beth. Whenever I use the GPS, I swear I have to look at that picture so closely. I cannot tell you how many turns I've missed.
I still use MapQuest. I have a car that doesn't have a GPS, and I prefer the map. Dad taught us on maps and how to read them, and I'm a map girl.
Susan was driving around that night, and around 9 o'clock, you remember she was in the car for an hour or so. She came up on a lake. I think it was called John D. Long Lake. I personally live in a water-ridden area, so I've passed a few boat ramps myself. And I do see that they're pretty long. So she drove onto a 75-foot boat ramp at the John D. Long Lake. And then she decided she was going to stop halfway down and get out of her car with both kids still strapped to the seat. Okay, do you see anything wrong with this picture yet?
Yeah.
She's just going to take a break, get out of the car, maybe walk around the car for a minute. Why she decided to park the car on the ramp is beyond me. She didn't stop there. She just stood there and watched as her car went into the lake. So she pretty much just left the kids in the back seat, strapped in, while she got out of the car and watched it roll down, halfway down that 75-foot boat ramp into the water. Me personally, I can't imagine the scenario of just sitting there watching that happen. It's unfathomable to me.
It is, to your own children.
Yeah. But 10 minutes later, she recovered because she was found crying on someone's porch about a quarter of a mile away. What am I thinking when I'm walking away from watching my children go down I guess at that point, 35-foot boat ramp and walking a quarter of a mile? You guys, that's going around the track one time. How long does that take you? And she gets to the porch about a quarter of a mile away from the boat ramp and told the homeowner that there was an African-American male that had jumped in her car while she was just sitting at a red light, minding her own business, then stole her car with her children inside. I kind of want you to remember that I had mentioned the red light, Beth, because that kind of comes into play. Okay, so police have a job to do. I'm going to say they're probably pretty good at it if they've been in policing for a while. but they became very suspicious pretty much from the get-go, because remember the red light that I just told you to remember that Susan was sitting at, right?
Right.
I've come up to red lights before where there's like a little trigger or something like a sensor. So you're sitting there at the light and then you're coming up on it and then all of a sudden the light turns green. This light in a very small town in Union, South Carolina, basically had one of those triggers, and it was impossible for Susan to be at the red light because as you were coming up on the light sensored it, and then you just drive through. The light would be green by the time you actually came to the intersection. She did say she was sitting at that red light, but the evidence shows that that was clearly impossible and that never happened. Through the entire ordeal of the kids being missing, David Smith did stand by Susan's side, and he believed that her account of the whole ordeal. Okay, so if I'm married to somebody like this and the kids disappear, I mean, I can kind of get it. Would you be in the same boat? I feel, okay, in his defense, she is my wife. I think, okay, well, I don't really know what's happening, but I'm definitely going to listen to what she has to say about it. So I definitely don't put, as far as any blame in this situation, I can't see that David could take any blame. He just stood by her side and believed her because she's his wife, right?
Yeah, a good liar too.
Oh, absolutely. Or is she? 2 days after the boys' disappearance, both Susan and David Smith took a polygraph. Because of those suspicions that they had on Susan's story about what happened at the intersection, they both took it. David passed his polygraph with flying colors, but Susan's polygraph showed deception, especially when she was asked if she knew the whereabouts of her two boys. I don't know how long it takes to take a polygraph, but I cannot imagine answering these questions and literally saying, I do not know where my boys are at. And then too, I don't know if how the laws are in Canada, because again, I haven't been there in a while, but you can't use a polygraph here in America. It won't hold up in court because, you know, some of them are considered to be unreliable.
I don't believe that they can use the results here either.
But isn't that still though, even though you can't use it in court, isn't that a great tool to use to get people to confess?
Yes.
I think, you know, we're building up on the pressure here. For the next 9 days, Susan went on national news with her husband and begged the mysterious carjacker to please return her children safely. And during one of her interviews, Susan literally said, "Whoever did this is a sick, emotionally unstable person." I actually threw in a couple pictures into some notes here that I'm going through. And I did this so that you can envision some of the photos of her sitting on the couch while she's being interviewed. Have you ever seen anybody interviewed on the news that's fake crying?
Yeah, I can think of a couple.
All this stuff is coming up. And when I did my research, I did actually go and look at some of these videos again. Yeah, she's still fake crying almost 30 years later. The community became just as suspicious because the population of Union, South Carolina was approximately 70% Caucasian and 30% African American. Think about that. I don't know what kind of community you have as far as diversity, Beth, but when you have 70-30, then many of the people in that community felt that it was a little bit unbelievable because someone would notice an African-American man driving around with two Caucasian children in the back seat. I guess there was just a lot of speculation on that. The sketch artist also felt that Susan was being deceptive. So sounds to me like the only person standing by her right now is her husband. As well, he probably should. But the sketch artist felt that Susan was being deceptive because she was just too vague. I actually added this sketch into our notes as we're talking here, and I wanted to get your feedback. What do you think about this sketch?
Well, a couple of things. It's pretty basic. There is nothing that really stands out about the picture. And two, why does she have a profile view? Is it because she was sitting next to him? The sketches I've seen are usually facing forward.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I don't think I've ever seen a sketch of somebody that everybody's trying to look out for. I've never seen a profile view. It's average. There's no distinguishing features. Between the lie detector test and the sketch artist and the community, Susan was crumbling at that point. On November 3rd, 1994, Susan was pretty much confronted by the authorities about all these inconsistencies in her story. So she finally broke down and admitted everything that happened. She had got her Dear Jane letter, Oh, she drove around to just think about things, strapped those poor children in the car, got to the lake and got out of the car with the kids strapped inside, 75-foot ramp. Now, she was only at about 35, probably 40 feet at the very most. But think about how much velocity that's going to be coming up off that car as it's speeding down that ramp. Earlier, when the kids were still missing, the police actually were looking. They went ahead and swept that lake, but they only, and I couldn't find any reasons why, but they went out only 30 feet. Because of that velocity of the car speeding down the ramp, the car actually drifted out to about 60 feet. The community's response that came from all of this was that Susan's brother was somewhat vocal. He apologized to the African-American community and said that Susan's actions did not really reflect what was going on where he stood in the family. He did not want Susan's accusations to cause division in the community between Caucasian and African-American Christian groups or the community. The Christian groups were also saying the same thing. They had a couple preachers in town that were pretty much saying that on Sunday morning at their church, that they needed to be forgiving. This was not the time to divide the community. And that's pretty much what Susan's brother said. So I have got to just applaud that community, because what a time to come together. I think that there's just so much bias and things going on. And this could definitely have really put a wedge into the community. But bravo to them that everybody came together on this. On November 6th, 1994, Michael Smith and Alexander Smith were buried together in a coffin. Then Susan went on to her trial after that. All right, so during her sentencing, about 8 months before Susan's trial, she was kept on watch in the jail because they were afraid that she was going to harm herself. Although Susan was clearly suffering from various mental disorders, she was still found fit to stand trial. And prosecutors originally sought the death penalty that required a unanimous vote from the jury. And after 5 days of testimony, it took the jury less than 3 hours to come back with the guilty plea. She was sentenced to 30 years to life in prison, where she sits today. Here comes David Smith again. Oh my gosh, my heart goes out to him. He had such a traumatic event happen in his life. But he's been strong, and he actually said during the trial or after the trial when Susan was sentenced to the 30 years to life in prison, that David did not agree with the jury's decision of that life in prison, but he respected it. He's since moved on. I read somewhere that he didn't think he ever could move on, but the beautiful outcome of this is that he did eventually have another daughter and a son, and he's doing really well today.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah, that is excellent. Just kind of coming back to Susan, she was initially sent to the Camille Griffin Graham Correctional Facility in Columbia, South Carolina. But while she was there, imagine this, Beth, she had sexual relations with a couple of the guards. There she is.
Of course she did.
Still the pattern, right?
Yeah.
She was eventually moved to the Leith Correctional Institute in Greenwood County, South Carolina. But in the midst of all this, I feel like human beings are still social creatures. Everybody should have a chance at love, right? She posted a personal profile on writeaconvict.com, but it was later taken down.
That's good. She shouldn't have been able to do that.
Wait, was it good that she posted on writeaconvict.com?
No.
I just want to know how in the world she posted on writeaconvict.com. Do they have like a public library on the facility that they could go to and just sign up?
Probably did.
Anyway, there we have it. So she's still sitting in the Leith Correctional Institute in Greenville, South Carolina, and is up for parole, get this, on November 4th, 2024. So that's 2.5 years from now.
I don't think she should be paroled when you do something like that so serious, and especially to your own children, and lying to the community.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think she needs to pay for her actions.
Well, I found a letter because I went back and I researched a little bit more, and she did write a letter about this entire ordeal, because journaling is very therapeutic and good for the soul, right?
Yeah.
I thought that I could probably read the excerpt. How do you say that? I'm going to read the letter.
You're doing good.
I'm going to read this letter from Susan. It's dated in 1999. Here we go. When I left my home on Tuesday, October 25th, I was very emotionally distraught. I did not want to live anymore, exclamation mark. I felt like things could never get any worse. When I left home, I was going to ride around a little while, and then I would just go to my mom's. As I rode and rode and rode, I felt that even more anxiety was coming up upon me. I no longer wanted to live. I felt I couldn't be a good mom anymore, but I didn't want my children to grow up without a mom. I felt I had to end our lives to protect us all from any grief or harm. And then she scribbled out something. I'm not sure. I can't even see what it says. I have never felt so lonely and so sad in my entire life. I was in love with someone very much, but he didn't love me and never would. I had a very difficult time accepting that, but I had hurt him very much and I could see why he could never be me. I think that she meant never be with me. When I was at John D. Long Lake, I had never felt so scared and unsure as I did then. I wanted to end my life so bad and was in my car ready to go down that ramp into the water. And I did go part way, but I stopped. I went again and stopped. I then got out of the car and stood by the car, a nervous wreck. Why was I feeling this way? Why was everything so bad in my life? I had no answers to these questions. I dropped to the lowest when I allowed my children to go down that ramp into the water without me. You know what? I think I'm done reading. There's a whole nother paragraph here. If anybody wants to see this, you can actually find this online. It is dated 11/3/1999. I don't think I want to listen to that anymore. What do you think?
No.
Yeah. Okay. I get
it. She needs to stay in jail.
Yeah. Well, 2.5 years. We'll see her driving around. Okay. With that being said, that's our very first podcast and that's our very first story. What other thoughts do you have? Any thoughts about the story itself, Beth?
No, I just keep going back to thinking of those two boys as mom was watching them go down. It's cruel. It's just unimaginable.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, goodness. You know what we haven't talked about? How do we end these things? There you have it. That's our first podcast. I'm sorry it was so grim. If you guys are looking to listen to anything that has to do with missing people, anywhere that we can maybe spread some hope, give you guys the things that you want to listen to, by all means, you can email us at dyingtobefound@gmail.com. And you can visit us on social media at Twitter and Instagram at dyingtobefound. And then also go visit our website at dyingtobefound.
Sounds good. Okay. We're getting our names out there.
We are. Keep listening.